Mueller House Meeting, Saturday afternoon, 5th April, 1975. We have talked quite a bit about purification, and the question arises, what is an important, or perhaps the most important factor to bring about the state of purity? Let us first consider certain aspects which are involved in the word meditation. There is, as we ordinarily know, discursive meditation, in which we set apart a particular time and then we practice meditation, taking some particular subject of meditation for the purpose. That is discursive meditation, whose culmination is always, should be, pure meditation, which is the state where the awareness of unity and communion is free of all concepts, of the thought process, and of all words. There is another aspect to meditation which goes on for 24 hours every day. And it is that aspect which is called mindfulness. The Buddhist term is samasati. Sama means, in the ordinary way, right. But in the religious context, its real meaning is perfect. It's not simply right in that somewhat lukewarm sense of the word right. It is perfect. Sama, perfect. Sati, mindfulness. Mindfulness meaning awakenedness, alertness of mind as it receives impressions through the senses, as it recalls things out of our memories, or as it involves itself in any deliberate thought process, like the thought process of a mathematician or scientist, or the thought process of a creative artist who has had an inspiration which he wants to work out in its own way. If you take the example of a musician, he just gets some particular theme as an inspiration, which sometimes may consist only of two notes, or perhaps even a single note, repeated rhythmically in different ways. Once the inspiration is there, he has to work it out. Now he works that out inside his own mind. This process is independent of the reception of external impressions. So he has to be awake in his mind inwardly. This too is mindfulness. He is very well aware of what's going on. He is watchful inwardly. That is the Buddhist presentation, samasati, mindfulness. Jesus used the words watch and pray. Watch. That watchfulness is the same mindfulness. It's true that in the New Testament, one feels that it is restricted to one particular aspect. Watch and pray, lest ye be led into temptation. That is one statement which is made. And in another gospel it is stated, watch and pray, for ye know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh. And naturally the reader, the devout Christian, thinks that it refers only to these two aspects. But that is not the case. This watchfulness is a perpetual watchfulness, a perpetual being alert and aware, not only of the impressions we receive from outside, which of course is very, very important, or the memories which arise from inside, or the thought process which we go through because we are trying to solve a problem or produce something, but particularly, and this is what touches us most as far as living the religious life is concerned, particularly our reactions to every single stimulus, whether from outside or whether it arises from within. Note, for instance, when we say go to a concert, we have our memories of previous performances of at least some of the items. Some may be totally new to us. Now, as a result of those memories, we naturally have standards. We say, so-and-so conducted this symphony thus, and so-and-so conducted it thus. And we have a standard of what we would like to hear as far as our enjoyment and appreciation of its perfection is concerned. So now, when we go to the concert, we have all these at the back of our minds, and we listen to the music, and as we listen, we are reacting back in our own minds, saying, oh, it's not the way Klemperer conducted it, or Herbert von Karajan, or somebody else. I prefer this, I would like it that way, and so forth. What is the consequence? We are not truly listening. We are not truly paying attention. We are up to a point hearing the sounds, but we are imposing back on that our judgments, our criticisms, our inner noise. This is in the brain, there is a noise then, spoiling the actual performance. To put it in another form, we are not actually living in the immediate percept. We are throwing all our concepts back at the percept and spoiling the immediate living experience at the moment. Now, this is the kind of thing that spoils everything in life. If you are going out for a walk, oh, it's so beautiful, these mountains are lovely, and so forth, we say, but they are not quite like what I saw in Switzerland, or quite like what I saw in the Rockies, or the Himalayas, or whatever it is. Now, you see, when I do that, I have lost communion, I have lost touch with the living reality now. For instance, to give a rather sad example, supposing I'm shaking hands with somebody who has just come in or to whom I've been introduced, and supposing my mind was wishing I was shaking hands with somebody else, what a way to greet him. You see? So, to be truly mindful means to pay full attention to the immediate percept. that which we are perceiving or experiencing at this moment, full attention, without judgments, without criticisms. If we do that, if we train ourselves that way, we will find that we go through all our experience in a state of freedom, of inward freedom. If we use all our previous experience and our concepts and our judgments and so forth, what happens is that the psyche says to the immediate experience, "Oh, I like this. I want more of it." And it gets attached. There is attachment. There is craving. And that craving will always find occasions where it cannot be satisfied. Then one is dejected. One is miserable. One is unpleasant to one's neighbor, or inconsiderate, and so forth. Or, on the other hand, one may have a reaction against the immediate percept, and that raises up violence in us. We say, "I don't like it. I must remove it. I must destroy it. I must get rid of it." So you see, this is the origin of craving and violence in our lives. Greed and hate come into play. The psyche says, "I like, this is pleasant, I want more of it, I get attached to it." Or the psyche says, "I don't like this, I'll get rid of it, I'll destroy it." And so the play of greed and hate, of craving and violence arises. If, therefore, we practice, as far as lies in our ability, pure mindfulness, then this psychical reaction begins to disappear. At first it won't, naturally, because we are like that. That is exactly how we function. But as time goes by, we will go through the whole experience with the mind completely poised, completely balanced, completely quiet inside itself. When that happens, the perception is a full, a true perception. Then you perceive intelligently, without bias, without prejudice, without preconceptions, and without assumptions to spoil the perceiving. You are free then, inwardly. Now, in that state, there is no binding attachment, nor is there destructive dislike. And this is of the utmost importance in our daily human life. If we look, if we are the least bit watchful of ourselves, we will find that our whole day is expended in a series of psychical reactions. "Oh, I like this. I don't like this." You see? But this is merely a state of conflict. This is not a state of communion. Communion is not attachment. Communion is not a thing of superficial affection. It is a permanent reality of all existence to which we have to awaken. Because whether consciously we are in communion or not, that is to say, as far as the conscious mind is concerned, the fact of the universe is that everything is in communion, because it is interrelated. The fact of communion is there, but we deny the fact of communion by our psychical reactions, by being in the state of unmindfulness. Now this is perhaps the most important practical aspect of living the religious life. Being continuously mindful. Now this type of mindfulness is one's 24-hour meditation. You might wonder why I say 24 hours, because the question will naturally arise, what happens when I sleep? If one practices mindfulness year after year, realizes that inward mental poise to a greater and a greater extent, when you go to sleep, you will go to sleep mindfully. What happens is that deeper faculties of the mind, which are not active ordinarily in the waking state, now take over the business of mindfulness. And you sleep mindfully. There is a very remarkable discourse by the Buddha in which he is being questioned by someone who comes to visit him to find out about all these things. And the question of being mindful in sleep arises. And the Buddha assures him that he goes to sleep perfectly mindfully. In the Upanishads too, you will find the same teaching given, that he who can enter the state of sleep watchfully is the one who knows what liberation could mean. It comes in one of the Yoga Upanishads. That is why these things are so little known to even the scholarly world. The scholars are generally conversant with the so-called major Upanishads, in which these things are not expounded. The real key to the major Upanishads, which are more like metaphysical presentations, the real key to them is in these so-called minor Upanishads, which consist of the Yoga Upanishads and various others also. And if you study those, and it is not easy to obtain translations of them, in German, Paul Deussen has translated 60 of them, including many of these major Upanishads. So though, if you are interested, you can procure Paul Deussen's book and study them. In his translations, he has shown this fact. There are English translations too, but unfortunately they are now very, very difficult to obtain, if at all. But in these Yoga Upanishads, you get the real key to all these things. So now, through mindfulness, one goes through the living percept, completely awake to the immediate now. If there is that mental balance and poise, if there is the clear perception of what is happening, you are in the state of communion. And for this, as you see, the body is a necessity. It has been an unfortunate thing in the religious texts which deal with living the religious life seriously. The body has been rather despised. It has been treated as if it were a thing of it was a thing of temptation, something vile, something which is evil in itself. Now I say categorically that no mistake could be greater. First of all, consider the fact that these same religious texts also tell you the opposite. The body is the temple of the Most High. You find it in the Acts of the Apostles, I think, and certainly in St. Paul's writings. Know ye not that the body, that ye are the temple of the Holy Spirit? They talk in those terms. And the Maitreya and the Skanda Upanishads, which are amongst the so-called minor Upanishads, they say outright that the body is a temple. The dweller in the body is no other than Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, the Hindu Trinity, and therefore the correspondent of the Holy Spirit in Christian theological presentation. The dweller in the temple is the Holy Spirit, Shiva. The Upanishads, of course, present it this way, that one's own business is to keep the temple clean, pure, and empty. This is the significant part of it, and empty. Keep it empty, and then the Lord comes in and fills it. What is the meaning of this emptiness? The freedom from all our mental fixations, all our fixed ideas, our beliefs to which we cling. Our beliefs are clothed in verbal form. They are concepts. And up to a point, they may bear correspondence with truth, with reality as it is, but only up to a point. They cannot be the complete expression of truth or of reality. Because if they were, then some of the supreme concepts which have been given to the world through the greatest geniuses, the spiritual geniuses and philosophical geniuses, would never require any change. They would be the complete truth there. What more can you give? There it is. But that is not the case. You look at the history of human thought, and you will find that always there is freshness coming in. And in the emergence of a new expression, the old one is shown to be faulty in some particular or other. So you see, our beliefs, our ideas obstruct the presence of the Lord, the presence of the Supreme Truth. That is why it is necessary for the temple to be empty of all these obstructions. Now, what does that mean? Ideas, thoughts, conceptions, they must of necessity be present in the moment. When you see something, naturally you have a conception of it, you have a perception. If you study something, you have ideas. If you think for yourself as an original thinker, you express that mental activity in terms of ideas which inspire you at the moment and inspire many others, maybe for years to come, maybe for centuries to come. They may have that vitality and power. That is perfectly true. But the idea is that which is thrown out by the creative living mind. What is important is the creative living mind. Mind being this mysterious energy which we cannot define, which we know nothing about really. You see? So the ideas are the things which are thrown out. The great thoughts are the things which are thrown out. Just as the body will take in food, it will digest, it will assimilate part of that food and build it into the body, and it will reject what is not wanted. the ideas and the thoughts are like that which the mind rejects, throws out. But we are mistaken when we cling to the ideas. We must, if we come across an idea, we can let it inspire us. If it is an idea which we haven't, if it is an idea of such a nature that we haven't ourselves reached that stage. But if we have reached that stage, there is no need for that at all. And with regard to ourselves, if we cling to our own ideas and say, this is the truth forever and ever, we are clinging to that which has to be rejected, merely an external shape, which is of no use, no value. If, for example, some goods are sent to you, wrapped up in a paper bag, it's not the paper bag that you want, it's what is inside the paper bag that you want. You cast aside the paper bag. It's like that. It's the creative mind which is the important thing. And the creative mind means that it represents your living process. See? So now, if the temple is to be pure, when the ideas and the thoughts arise, look at them. Just look at them. Observe them very carefully, very intently. And as you observe them, if you practice the discipline properly, you will find that those ideas and thoughts will just change. They will melt away, so to say, like snow melting under the sun. They will change. And that change is the right sort of change. That's the change which means real growth. Not a mere modification, like rearranging the same furniture in the room, putting it in a different place. Not a mere modification, but a change which means real growth. Take the body as an example. One is born, and if there is real growth, well, there is change taking place. But changes can take place in the body which are not real growth. In fact, they may be illnesses. They may be accidents which deprive you of a limb or something. There is change there. You see? No one ever dreams of trying to stop a little child from growing to a full-grown man or woman, does one? But we do that with respect to the mind. We cling to the ideas, the thoughts, the words, and say, this is ultimate truth. Now, this is where mindfulness comes in. Watch every single idea, every single thought as it arises. And it will generally arise in our everyday life as a reaction to all the sense stimuli. And to the arising of memories inside ourselves. Now this, those of you who have gone into psychotherapy, you will see at once the significance of this. What is one of the main reasons why our neuroses or psychoses become worse and worse? It is because we cling to our illness. We hold tight to it. We won't let it go. But if we were really mindful and we observed what's happening inside our own self, you see, and we neither reject it violently nor get attached to it for some reason or other, but just observe it as such, it undergoes the necessary transformation. I'm putting very, very briefly and oversimplifying, in fact, the whole process as it takes place. But it is along these lines that we can progress as far as our spiritual life is concerned. So, mindfulness assumes a place of first importance in the actual practice which enables man to come to flower, to fruition. Let us go back then to this attitude towards the body as a vile thing, a thing of sin and shame and all the rest of the nonsense, you see, which has rather besmirched the beauty of religious teachings where the religious life is concerned. We'll take that other teaching. The body is the temple of the Lord. What do I mean when I say body? Ordinarily, I say, oh, this physical body, made it's bones and flesh and blood and skin and all the rest of it. Yes, that is the body. But does that tell me the whole truth of the body? Is there nothing more? I don't know. Supposing I were to study the body like a doctor would study, you see, everything about the anatomy, the physiology, and all the rest of it with respect to the body. All right, I have gained a certain amount of knowledge of the body. Having gained that knowledge, do I not still persist in talking of the mind as something separate? Of talking of the spirit, or the life energy, or the soul, or whatever you like to call it, as something separate? Well, is it separate? Have you ever seen a body, a physical body, without any mind, without any mental phenomena attached to it? Have you ever come across a mysterious entity called mind or soul walking down from Kleist to Elmau without a body? You haven't, and I haven't. And I venture to say you never will. You never will see a disembodied spirit. That which is living, that which is present, is a totality in itself. And where human beings are concerned, every single phenomenon which the living organism shows is a phenomenon which characterizes the entire organism, the entire integrated organism. Take the body alone, just for the sake of argument. Can I cut out my liver and throw it away, saying that it has been troubling me? Body would be dead. Finished. Can I treat my lungs that way? I can't. How then can I treat any other part, regard any other part, which is not actually physical and solid in that way? And what's more, why should I presume that what infinitesimally little knowledge I have with regard to the body is the whole truth about the body? That is why I myself always regard the word body as including everything else. If there is no body, there is no such thing as mental phenomena being present there. If there is no mind, there is no such thing as body and a living person there. No such thing. It is an integrated whole. We have never woken up to this great truth, that the living person is an integrated whole. Now, do we stop there? Do we say that I see a living person and I admit that I do not know every aspect which composes that person? But do we stop there then, having said that? Is that living person, that body, perpetually separate from everything else? Consider the simple fact of breathing. I breathe in air. The air is from outside, as I say. That air goes into me. Now, is that air part of my body? Well, anybody will say, well, of course it is part of your body. And then, when I breathe out, has a part of me become disembodied? You see? And that same air which I breathe out, and which spreads right through the room, everybody else in the room also breathes in. You see what's happening? You and I are breathing as one body when we have the larger view upon it. It's the same with food. If I eat an apple, that apple has become Firoz Mehta, having gone inside him. And when the process of digestion and assimilation and rejection is all worked out, what happens? Does a bit of Firoz Mehta become disembodied and cast out? You see, if you sort of feel this interplay of living in this universe, if you feel that, you will find that the word body must necessarily include the totality. It's an extraordinary thing. If you meditate deeply on this, let the mind be quiet and just consider these simple facts about the body and wake up from inside to the full significance and reality of what we commonly call my body, you will find that the word body stands for the entire universe. Therefore, this particular thing, which is visible to another person's senses, this particular thing is not my body. It is part of the body. And this is the marvel of existence, that the totality expresses itself through the particular in innumerable different ways. The universe is a wonderful universe. You can't begin to relate the beauty and the marvel of the whole universe. And when you are aware of the body that way, you're really awakened to it all. Can you ever dream of hurting what is commonly called my own body or somebody else's body? Or any object at all? You see, this ties back to what we were talking about this morning a little bit, about the virtue of harmlessness. If we awake to this, really awake to it, naturally, spontaneously, we will be saved from harming anything and everything, anybody and everybody around us. So you see, when that awareness grows and grows, then this body becomes the pure temple. And the dweller in it is the one and only ultimate creative energy, the one total reality, God, transcendence, use any word you like. See, this sort of awakening means that enlightenment is taking place. And with the enlightenment, purification is taking place. Now, tie this up with our considerations this morning regarding the path. Or perhaps was it yesterday? I said the path is through your own living being. If we can truly wake up to this, then we will understand what the Buddha meant when he told one of his great disciples, Subhuti by name. He said, Subhuti, just the path is enlightenment. Just enlightenment is the path. Now you see how we can utilize our own bodies, as we call them, in order to let this enlightenment emerge. Just naturally and sweetly, if you like. By being awake, fully awake. Let me just repeat the very significant, the most important point in connection with the practice of mindfulness. Watch the reactions which take place in the brain from moment to moment as we go through every single experience. Watch the reactions. This is the most important thing, because it is the watching the reactions and watching them without getting attached to them or without rejecting them, without fear, without violence, without greed, just a pure watching, then you will find an extraordinary thing happening. Immanuel Kant said that it is not possible to know anything in itself. We only know the mental picture that is formed in our brain by that thing. When I say I am looking at that microphone, what I really am looking at is the mental picture which is immediately formed in my brain by the ordinary physical processes which go on, the light rays being reflected from that object and passing through my eye and making an impression there and so forth and so forth. You see? We don't know the thing in itself. But in the state of communion, you are that particular thing. In mind and consciousness. Obviously, you can't become a microphone. You are physically what you are. You see? And that is a microphone. But in mind and consciousness, the barrier between the thing in itself and the person in himself has dissolved. The veils are removed. And you see in a way which is quite indescribable. It's quite extraordinary. Attempts have been made through the centuries to put things like this into words. There are some treatises in this connection, but I would suggest don't try to read them. They make no sense whatsoever to us, because the spoken word necessarily has to be interpreted in its dictionary meaning, and its dictionary meaning is no use really for this purpose. This is a thing which has to be experienced. There is particularly, well, perhaps more than one experience in life which many human beings can go through. One is the experience of this magical uprising of pure love. A person meets another person and something happens. That which happens in that instant is the action of transcendence itself, displaying its unity, its complete interrelationship in terms of particulars. This is that magic of love. And then suddenly that magic is gone and the brain starts up and the emotions start up. Words are given to it all, and it is once again wrapped up in veils. But in that extraordinary moment, that first flash which arises, I have completely forgotten myself. I am not there. And because I am not there, that supreme reality of love is present. This is the peak point of mindfulness. The peak point of mindfulness corresponds, is identically the same as the pure meditation in which there is the supreme communion. So you see, mindfulness, this constant mindfulness, this 24-hour meditation is the path. And this mindfulness will be specially characteristic of you. It is you alone who can be mindful in that way. And it is different from anybody else's way, because your constitution is different from everybody else's. And therefore, the way this functions, this manifests, is unique and individual to you. This is the beauty, the marvelous beauty of the entire created world. Everything is absolutely perfect and wonderful in itself. We cover it up through our ignorance, our craving, and our violence. And the cure for it all is this perfect mindfulness, which releases the perfect attentiveness, which means realized communion here and now.